Good morning. Well now, didn't we land with a sobering jolt this week?
The latest tweet from the head of the HSE, Paul Reid, tells us there are now 921 people in hospital. That's in excess of the peak level of the first wave, which stood at 881.
That was Wednesday morning, and it's almost unbelievable. But believe it, we must. Even Sunnyside Up himself was reeling.
As I heard somebody on Morning Ireland, one of the contributors of Morning Ireland said, it'll all be fine by the end of the year. I thought, it's January the 6th. By the end of the year? It's just started. I was kind of thinking, at best Patrick's Day, we'd be in the business. And then I thought, nah, we'll push it out to June. We may have to push. Apparently, not only does the virus like to party, it likes to mate. That's not very helpful. Because now we have these offshoots of the freaking thing, and it's going to be, it could be all sorts of horror stories coming down the tracks. Or not. Who knows? But we'll keep going, and we will keep, as I say, endeavour to be positive. And, you know, as I say, the vaccinations are going in. People are getting them, and they are going to, then we'll all get them, and it'll be good. It'll be very, very good. In the meantime,
we sit in, yet again, lockdown 3. Sure, pull up a chair, my old frenemy. But just what in hell happened to land us in this position? On the News at 1, Brian Dobson asked Dr. Agarista Baca from the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control how it had all gone so horribly wrong.
Is it clear whether the new, particularly this new variant that's emerged in the UK and which is said to be much more transmittable, is it clear the extent to which that might be contributing to this?
Yes, this is something that we are following very closely. It is true that the British colleagues have clearly said that it is more transmissible from person to person. The good news is that at least it doesn't affect the severity of the presentation of in the clinical cases. What happens right now is that all the countries are in a searching mode. They are trying to see if they have this variant. And as you probably have seen in the media, and we report daily to our focal points, that more and more countries are finding the variant already in their territories. It's understandable since the first cases in the UK go back to September.
On Tuesday's Drive Time, Cormac put this to infectious disease specialist Professor Sam McConkie.
25% of the cases that we have now are of the new variant of the virus. Now, do you think that's contributed to the explosion in cases that we've seen in recent days?
So it's part of the mix, but still only a minority. So, you know, even if you were to take out that quarter, you're still left with an awful big increase of all the other variants that are circulating. So I think there's a risk of new variants of concern in any viral disease with RNA changes and mutations coming, and they can change their behaviour a little bit. Sometimes they don't, sometimes they do. So I don't think it's fair to just blame the current problem of these, you know, very dangerous number of ICU cases, hospitalised cases, high rates that we're talking about earlier, purely on the new variant, because as you've just described, the majority of the ones we're seeing are not the new variant.
Majority not the new variant, says Professor Sam McConkie. Well, back to Agarista Baca, who brought a simpler insight into why it may have spread.
Unfortunately, people are not afraid so much anymore. I think in the spring, people were really, really cautious and followed really closely all the guidelines and the instructions. However, now there is this COVID-19 fatigue, and people are not afraid anymore, despite the death rates.
We're kind of rattled now, though, make no mistake. And there's a horrible sense of déjà vu from all of this. On Wednesday, Philip, in the seat for Clare, put this to Dr. Mary Favier, member of NEFID and COVID advisor to the Irish College of General Practitioners.
It is that lag period, isn't it, before people develop serious symptoms and require hospitalisation, can be 7-10 days. So the figures that we saw last night of 5,000, 6,000 the night before, it's going to be a while before that hits the hospitals. Today's figure from Paul Reid of 881 in hospitals is not a reflection of what's actually out there.
It's not. It's generally 2 weeks from when people have a positive test to when they really get symptoms that becomes concerning and need hospital admission. So So unfortunately, yes, the worst is yet to come. And all we can do now is, first of all, people present to their GPs if they've got concerning symptoms, either for testing or if they are COVID positive and unwell, but absolutely reduce our movements. Literally, just stay at home. Because we have exceeded all capacity from March, April, and now we have a hospital system that's going to have very significant difficulty in staying upright unless we really assist it.
And pressure on the hospitals is building. Earlier on Morning Ireland, Catherine Motherway, a consultant in the intensive care unit in University Hospital Limerick, spoke to Gavin Jennings.
The head of the HSC, Paul Reid, was talking earlier in the week about the scenario of the number of people who are likely to need ICU beds by the middle of this month, which isn't too far away. He said it could range from between 250 to 430. Now,
yes.
What will you do if you run out of beds or staff to intensively care for patients?
I was asked this question at the beginning of this pandemic by one of your colleagues, Mary Wilson. And in a pandemic time, if you do run out of resources, you have to apply different ethics. And there is an ethical framework published by the HSE. It applies across all patients requiring critical care, both COVID and non-COVID. It would require us to possibly slightly make life like a different. Maybe we'd be looking at saving the most lives as opposed to admitting the sickest first. We devoutly hope that will not happen, and that will not happen if we stop this disease now. You know, you decide on patient admission based on if they will benefit from it. If they won't, obviously you'll give them care in another area. If you think they will benefit, you offer them care. If you have too many people for a finite resource, then we have to actually make choices. And that is not really a medical thing, it's almost a societal thing. And should that actually end up to come to pass, I think it would be wise of us as a medical community to communicate with society and tell them that is going to happen. It is not happening now. We are offering critical care as we normally do to people who would benefit from it. But there is no doubt that we are in a way already triaging healthcare services, because we're cancelling elective surgery, we're cancelling elective work. We've already told those people they're not currently going to get their care, they're going to get it eventually, and we're going to offer time critical care at the moment, as we absolutely have to do. But that possibility does exist if we don't control viral transmission.
And on Drive Time, Sarah asked Coleman O'Loughlin, president of the Intensive Care Society and consultant in intensive care at the Mater Hospital, about the demographic of people he is seeing.
Well, we're seeing very similar patterns to the last time. These are patients who tend to have other comorbidities. And the classic ones that we've been talking about since the very start, diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiac disease, are all recurring again. So I think having the numbers very low in the community allowed those patients to be protected from kind of last May until quite recently. But the very rapid rise in community transmission has now spilled into those high-risk categories once again, and that's what's filling the hospital beds and then spilling over into intensive care, so those patients are fortunate to get sick enough to acquire that level of care. So nothing really has changed on that front, and I suppose an important message I'd like to get across is that the therapy that we have for this disease hasn't changed a whole pile as well. There's been a little bit more comfort in some of the interventions that we use, such as proning patients when they're on a ventilator. We have found out that the drug dexamethasone, which is a steroid, helps some patients, but certainly not all patients, and is not a panacea by any measures. So we haven't really gotten very far with an overall cure for this disease at the ICU level. So that message kind of got, I think, misrepresented in some of the media over the summer months later, that, you know, care, the ability to cure these patients has improved an awful lot. That's not necessarily true. So we're faced with a huge number of patients without the kind of comparable improvement in the ability to cure those patients. And that's why we're so concerned at the moment.
It's like a series of body blows that just don't stop. And steel yourself for this next clip. Yesterday on Morning Ireland, Gavin asked this of Dr. Cliona Ní Chealaigh, infectious diseases and internal medicine physician at St James's Hospital.
Can you describe what being in intensive care because of COVID is like for patients?
So being in intensive care is, It's often quite a traumatic experience for people. So when you're, despite the best efforts of everybody who works in intensive care, so people who are in intensive care frequently are intubated and ventilated, people with COVID. So that means having a tube put down your throat, down your trachea, down your breathing tubes into your lungs, and a machine that's pushing the air in and out of your lungs. And it wouldn't really be possible to cope with that, to have that degree of, you know, something in your throat and controlling your breathing, unless you were very heavily sedated. So a lot of the patients that are in ICU are, you know, essentially like you'd be during an operation. They're anaesthetized. And you can be like that for a number of weeks, and it has a lot of complications. So being hooked up to a ventilator, being sedated like that, for example, you're very prone to getting other infections because you have a tube going straight down into your lungs. And because of the sedation, because you're not up and moving, your muscle, you lose a huge amount of muscle tone, and you can have damage, permanent damage to your muscles and your nerves. So when people come out of ICU, it's a really steep road, and a very long and difficult road for them to do in order to rehabilitate and get back to where they were. And people often have flashbacks, similar to PTSD, similar to what people would get from wars, from being in ICU and from being on these machines. It's a very invasive situation to be in, and you can't talk, you can't move, there are lights on, there's noise on. It's pretty traumatic for people. So it's a fantastic last resort when we need it. You know, it's amazing, but it's really not something that you would wish on anybody unless there was no alternative.
Dr. Cliona Ní Chealaí on Morning Ireland yesterday. However, chink of light. Wednesday saw the Moderna vaccine approved by the EU. So that is something to cling to when you toss and turn at 4 a.m. But on Wednesday, more restrictions. Construction reduced to essential work only. Click and collect. Now just click. And as for a takeaway pint, step away. And schools were to close, with the exception of Leaving Cert students who would attend 3 days a week. But this would meet resistance. On Thursday, Philip spoke to the Moss Ryan School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College.
Minister Dara O'Brien on this programme a half an hour ago, Minister Norma Foley on Drive Time yesterday, both said that the government's advice from NPHET on sending Leaving Cert students in for 3 days a week was that it was safe to do so. In your opinion, is it safe?
No, not at all. The position of the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group is that we should not be opening schools for Leaving Cert students. If we opened up every Leaving Cert class tomorrow, 1 in 10 of all those classrooms, if they only had 15 students, will have COVID-19 in them. That risks spreading it to other students and to the families and the teachers and the teachers of that families. I don't think that's acceptable. If I was a parent of a Leaving Cert student, I would have a huge degree of anxiety about sending my son or daughter to school. And if I was a Leaving Cert student myself, I would not be going into the school building.
So what did those students think? Well, those who contacted Liveline and Joe gave their views.
I think the government and Minister Foley are trying to do their best to ensure that the Leaving Cert goes ahead in the most traditional sense. But I just think as well that Public Health, NPHET, Tony Houlihan and everybody else has obviously decided or made the decision that schools should be closed at the moment. And by opening the schools for the 3 days a week, you know, it's contradicting that. And it's the fact that we're still going into a class with 29 other people and still sitting in a classroom where community transmission is there. I think that we missed 3 months of school last year. We're facing another month now. So it's 4 months of school. It's nearly a quarter of our 2 years of education, of our senior cycle. And in my opinion, and I think I've spoken to a lot of people my age in different schools and stuff, and the consensus is that they would like predicted grades, but there are a large amount of students as well that would like to sit exams.
Up from September to Christmas, everything was fine. I thought we were going to have a Leaving Cert. But the last 2 days, like, all my friends are worried, everything.
Mm. Bria Carr, this three-day option, what do you think of that?
Personally, I don't think that's acceptable, because in our school, the conditions are they're far too cold. We're sitting in the class, like, with hats on, gloves on, our jackets, the breeze is blowing in the window and the blinds are banging. Like, it's so distracting. Because if you're throwing students into these cold conditions, they're bound to get sick, and then they're missing more days off school, they're missing more of the course. And if you're bringing them in and out, day in, day out, it's distracting for them, it's unfair.
Leaving Cert students talking to Joe on Wednesday afternoon. Back to Philip on Thursday morning. He canvassed the views of Ciarán Christie, General Secretary of the Association of Secondary Teachers in Ireland.
Our reaction is that we're completely startled, somewhat baffled and very disappointed in the decision, in that it's rushed, it's reckless, it's poorly thought through. And we're calling for the minister to reconsider it and to pause the prospect, because it's just not a runner from our point of view at this point in time.
And just after six that same evening...
I ask you about some breaking news that's just coming onto my screen here. The ASTI Standing Committee just said they'll only engage in remote teaching or learning provision from Monday, January the 11th.
And that was that. Online learning it is, at least until the end of the month. And as to the form this year's Leaving Cert will take, did I mention deja vu? Back in a bit. Welcome back. This week saw the celebration of Nollag na Mban, but Fiona Looney was squinting at it.
It's kind of like the afterthought. It's sort of like, you know, well, it wasn't Christmas grand, take down the decorations. Is there anything we're forgetting? Oh yeah, you needn't make the dinner tonight. So it's a kind of a, you know, it's a little bit, it's a crumb, it's a stale crumb from the Christmas table. But like, it's better than nothing, because when I was growing up, you know, like yourself, Ray, it wasn't Nollag na Mban in Dublin. It was the Epiphany.
Yes.
Or occasionally Little Christmas. And it was all about three wise men instead of 100,000 exhausted women, which is obviously what it should have been about.
Oh, she might well have a point there. But two women happy to celebrate were Rady Pete and Katie Kim. They'd come together to sing for Nollag na Mban and talk to Sean Rocks on Arena, who was at risk of coming a cropper with quite the analogy.
On the surface of it, when I heard Rady Pete and Katie Kim, now I don't want to be disparaging to either of you in any way in terms of how I describe your music now, but Rady, I think of you as, you know, a kind of a gritty traditional feel to the way you sing. Almost there's something quite ancient is what I hear in your voice.
How dare you?
Here I go for a second insult then. And Katie, when I hear yours, I hear a more ambient kind of chilled out feel. On the surface of it, not two voices or two styles of music that I would necessarily put together. Did you talk about that, Katie?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what we were thinking initially when John Pearson had told us, suggested that we work together. I mean, the two of us thought that ourselves, and it wasn't until, I mean, it was something that we talked about at length before we even got together to try and start working on anything or even see if the writing worked or the singing worked. So we did. We got together and we just tried out a few different songs and tried out a few different things and got really excited about it after it, because it did work, and somehow it just all came together and it all fell together. It was great. It was a lovely surprise because, you know, I think maybe that the two genres you wouldn't put together necessarily instantly, but yeah, sometimes collaborations don't always work, and I was really, especially for me, they haven't always been successful in the past, but I'm just really happy that it worked out, and it worked out. Yeah, I'm really excited about this.
Searching desperately for a food analogy, and the only thing that's coming into my head is rhubarb and custard, and I know one of you will be insulted that I'm going to call you the rhubarb of the mixture.
I was actually going to say I want to be the custard.
Yeah. I'll be rhubarb.
Oh, could have got horribly wrong. That was Rady Pete and Katie Kim with Sean. But the mix of those two ingredients, rhubarb, custard, whatever you're having yourself, resulted in something really beautiful, which they described as doom folk. So he's
I'm
We Lee is the name of the song from Reedy Pete and Katie Kim, as heard on Arena. Now, with everything going on, all good intentions of dry January might have gone out the window. A glass can take the edge off, and sure, who could blame you? But maybe pause, because what might soothe of a Saturday night might become something else entirely on a lockdown Monday. Architect Hugh Wallace spoke to Cormac and Sarah on Drive Time about breaking his sobriety during the last lockdown. And before he got into that, he talked about his own father's alcoholism and how he had stopped drinking.
My mum hated raw steak, and unfortunately my dad was drunk, couldn't cook properly. Now, there's a background that my father was drinking all of his life. And unfortunately, or fortunately as it turned out, my father didn't cook my mum's steak, and my mum got the steak and wrapped it around his face. He left the house. We didn't know where he'd gone or what circumstances he'd disappeared. And we were informed then a number of days later that he'd signed himself into a rehabilitation clinic. And the next time I saw him was 7 months later, and he never drank again.
And Hugh acknowledged that having a father who was an alcoholic had profoundly affected him, his relationship with others and with alcohol. Sober for 8 years, he took a drink during the last lockdown.
Can you describe your state of mind at that moment during lockdown, when you chose to drink again?
I found the whole COVID lockdown was extraordinary, because it was like in walking into the unknown. And I'd have to say, on a Tuesday, you just go, it was like a COVID Tuesday. And you didn't know what was happening. People, they talked about, particularly in the first lockdown, people being sick was a distant thing. It wasn't in your face, other than for people who were in care homes or working in meat factories. And the whole thing just got on top of you. And I'd have to say, I just turned around and said, I deserve to drink. I could go and tell you it was agony to make that choice. But unfortunately, it wasn't.
And when you sip, I don't know, what drink did you have, or does it matter?
Oh, 2 glasses of wine. It didn't really matter what it was. To myself that I was allowed to have a drink.
And what happened when you sipped the wine for the first time in 8 years? Was it?
I can't. I'm sorry about that. I'm not being glib. Let's be quite honest. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to tell you, I didn't want to finish the second glass.
And just why did he manage to stop after that second glass?
But then for you, you're into your second glass and you didn't want to finish it. Was that a mental thing?
I felt stupid.
Okay.
I felt stupid. I said, what am I doing? I enjoy it. I can't tell you what sobriety is like. To wake up in the morning and see the frost on the ground and enjoy it. Alcohol is exceptionally complex, particularly as a child of an alcoholic. And I was an adult child of an alcoholic.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean it's...
If you live with alcoholism when you're a child, you do not develop your emotions. You do not develop attachments. People go through life and are never able to actually develop adult relationships because of their fear of living at home, because of abuse, neglect, isolation, daily chaos. That's what's happening today. Today and every day, and every day tonight, this year, there will be 10,000 children living in fear of their parents, of what is going to happen. And they are isolated and can talk to no one. And that's what we need to talk about.
Architect Hugh Wallace on Monday's Drive Time. Written and performed by Norma Sheehan, all out of Happy Faces was the fresh offering from the Drama on One.
Hello?
Hello, you've reached Trampoline Land. Sorry, we are currently closed to the public due to COVID-19. Our summer camps are running for July and August, but presently all places are full. If you wish to be placed on a cancellation list, please leave your name and number and we'll get back to you. Also, leave some details about your child after the beep. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Margaret Nolan, 086-932-5722. That's 086-932-5722. My daughter's name is Sally. She's driving me mad. She's not really. She's nine. So it's just herself and myself. She doesn't really have a father. Well, she has a father, but I mean, she's not the Immaculate Conception or anything, but Angel Gabriel would be more useful. She loves trampolining. She loves activities, getting out. Obviously, she hasn't got out much lately. Who has? I've tried to mix with the neighbours. They have a trampoline, actually. But no, they're not keen. They're not keen. They're not up for the mingling. See, I work for the HSC two nights a week. I'm a carer. So no one wants to come near us, really, because I'm filthy. Well, I'm not filthy. We do wash, but we're risky. So then I come home, bring my risks home to my daughter. Like, we do wash, we do. And if she got a place, God, I'd sheep dip her, I'd bath her every night in tea tree or whatever. She stays with my sister actually while I'm working, while I do overnights. But my sister puts her in the garage, just leaves her there with a screen. And she's not allowed to touch anyone, anything. And Sal thinks it's her fault. And then she comes back home to me for the hugs. And I don't even know if I'm allowed to hug her.
All out of Happy Faces, the drama on one from Norma Sheehan. And from the challenge of keeping young children occupied to the ache of missing adult children living abroad. Here's Kate Durant on A Living Word.
Our words collide as our worlds collide. My daughter's endless stream of photographs showing the bright lights in the big city she calls home. Her videos teeming with the laughter of young people who quiver with expectation of their unrevealed future. I look at these images as I walk in the quiet grounds of the castle in the village I call home, and reciprocate with a picture of a heron by the water, the dying sunlight dappling through the winter trees, as I text, "Do you remember?" Our phones have vibrated continuously through this long year of learning as we pass reassurance back and forth like a baton, only to find ourselves a long way from the finish line in this never-ending relay. Like everyone else, we're not enjoying this new normal much. Such a small world, we used to say in amazement, as we spoke of shopping trips to New York and of weekends in European cities that we booked on a whim with a plastic card and a promise of payment. Sure, you only live once, Mum. But this world is not so small anymore, and when 5 kilometres is your everything, and then only if essential, Australia might as well be another planet in a far distant galaxy. Off you go, we said. You must travel, explore the world. Life is short. Grab it. You can be anything, live anywhere. Follow your dreams, live your life. Sure, you only live once. You can come home any time. We said that too. But we don't say that anymore. We talk now of restrictions, of quarantine, of the race for vaccine. And we pray for a fair wind and a following sea to keep us all safe and well, as we humble ourselves in the knowledge that we are not in charge. And none of these plans were ever ours to make.
That was very beautiful. That was Kate Durant on A Living Word. Now, regular radio listeners will be used to things like dropped lines and delays, nature of the beast, particularly at the moment. But some radio professionals have ways and means to fill the gap, so to speak. Here's Kevin McGahern with Ray.
Because this is the thing that we've come across a lot since the pandemic started, because we're using new technology. And what I try to do is I ask the question and then say something at the end of it. I'd say something like, so tell us about the show, Kevin, if you would.
I know, and I'll try and come in as soon as I feel you coming to the end of your sentence, Ray. You go now, I'm finished my sentence.
Or we could do it the news way, you know, the gap will remain.
Come on, Ray, come on, keep this going. You need to speed up.
So it's a panel show.
We need to fill in these gaps. Dead air. Dead air is no air on radio. It's the first rule they should have told you coming in from Kildare.
You mean dead air like that? Ooh, rebel. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Thursday, when the decision was made not to reopen schools, this also extended to children with special needs. Friday's Liveline was filled with parents describing the impact of this decision on their lives and that of their children. Here's Marie.
I have a teenager with special needs, autism, ADHD and an intellectual disability, and who presents with very challenging behaviours. When we found out that the schools were not going to open, that was his lifeline and our lifeline just gone. Yeah. I mean, we just got through Christmas by our fingernails, and that was coming off the back of the last lockdown. And just to think now that there's nothing, they have, you know, my child has to get up and get out and go somewhere. And for them not to have the school now and nowhere to go, we're back to the challenging behaviours all day, every day. And destruction. Destruction. I don't even know where to begin, to be honest with you. He needs round-the-clock care for a start, assistance with everything. Anything that he had learnt at school, he's regressed now, so I'm back to even spoon-feeding him now again. He's developed an obsession with me completely, where he'll only allow me to do things for him. And he has to have my attention all day, every day. If I so much as look at anybody else in the house, something is thrown or broken or... Just chaos from morning till night. And then there's the shouting and the calling. It's constant as well. So I don't even have... I can't even finish a brain thought. A thought that forms in my brain because it's constantly interrupted. And I have other kids in the house as well that need my attention. So just to get from one day to the next, it's nearly impossible.
That is a hard road. And Joe picked up on one particular phrase Mary had used.
What was the phrase you used? You got through Christmas by the skin of your teeth or whatever.
Hanging on
by your fingernails. What do you mean by that, Marie?
I mean, just the day starts, for example, let's say 5:36 every morning with screaming and banging. The first thing I'm faced with is feces all over the walls, which I can't even tackle at that point because I have to keep my eyes. I'm always on guard. I have to keep my eyes on the other kids because I have to watch him the whole time. So, you know, he gets his shower and his bath and medication. And then when he's had his breakfast, he's looking to go. He's looking to go to school. I mean, he doesn't even understand it when it's a weekend. Never mind a lockdown or Christmas holidays or another lockdown. Then that's when we start driving, circling the roads. We start driving around and around and then there's nowhere to go. We used to be able to bring him for walks, which he loved. But now he won't, even in -3 degree weather, he'll take his clothes off when you're out. So you're frantic trying to get back to the car. You always have to be aware of your surroundings or who's there or how close you are to the car in case anything unpredictable happens. And this happens all the time now. And often when you get back into the car, he might strip again in the car. So you're constantly, you're always alert and watching him and trying to drive and get back. And then when you get back, there's nowhere to go again. So the whole vicious cycle starts again. It's impossible to do it to this severity for this long. And now to think there's no school on Monday, I'm just at my wit's end. I just don't know. Like, some provisions have to be made. Okay, something has to be done.
Mary with Joe. And Breda also phoned in. She is mother to 9-year-old twins, a boy and a girl, both with autism, both nonverbal and with intellectual disabilities.
The school and their parents brought those kids from being afraid to leave the house to going to school and be very happy. My little boy spent the first definitely 3 years, preschool 2 years and another year or two in primary school and in the special school, standing against the wall crying. He cried when they had to leave the classroom. He cried when they had to go into another building. He went from that state to being a 9-year-old last Christmas, you know, January, February in school, being involved in with his peers, playing with them or alongside them, taking part in circle time, group activity. He toilet trained himself pretty much in March. He decided, okay, I'm done with these pull-ups. He was 8, but he did it. And over the last month, I've seen a spiral of disintegration, of the little cratering going back into his head and into his isolation since last March. But over the last month, it would break anyone's heart to see the suffering that child has gone through. He has lost all his toileting skills, which he had absolutely developed 100%. Mm-hmm. And we went from a happy, self-contained, beautiful little boy to a distraught, distressed, beautiful little boy who was actually admitted through A&E to hospital this week and put on medication for anxiety and overwhelm.
Oh my God.
That is the impact. That is why I'm on here, because it's okay to say special needs and days spent in school and how many hours the teachers work. I don't care. I'm thinking about getting through tomorrow. I'm thinking about taking that calendar down, that we were circling days and counting down to school next Monday. I had to take it off the wall this morning. And what do I put up there, Joe? What do I do?
Breda on Friday's Liveline. Heartbreaking stories. It cannot be accused of being a slow news week. In fact, it was almost impossible to keep up. On Wednesday night in Washington, what President Donald Trump had called for at a rally earlier that day had come to pass. The storming of the Capitol was truly shocking and frightening. Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan was on Thursday's Morning Ireland to describe what had happened.
When members of Congress were just beginning that process of formally counting the Electoral College votes in order to certify Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election, large crowds of Donald Trump supporters had gathered outside the Capitol building, but then they started clashing with police and they started breaking through these barriers. First, they filled the steps leading up to the Capitol, then they started getting into the building. They smashed through windows and doors. They were roaming the halls, these bizarre images of them wandering through the chambers, sitting in chairs, breaking into offices, ripping things off the walls, taking selfies next to statues. Security staff had to use furniture to barricade the doors. There were armed standoffs. Some members of Congress had to shelter under chairs and desks. Others were whisked away to secure locations. One woman was shot dead. Three other people died from medical emergencies. In all, 52 people were arrested and explosive devices were recovered. It was absolute chaos. It was violence. It was unprecedented scenes that we saw playing out yesterday in the Capitol building.
However, Congress resumed and Joe Biden was indeed ratified as having won the election and would be the next president of the United States. But what of Donald Trump? As resignations from his administration tumble down around him, there is talk of invoking the 25th Amendment, which would declare him unable to perform his duties and remove him from office. But for his supporters, and there are many of them, the issue of this election was not going away.
In one way, the protest is now over, but in another, despite all the evidence to the contrary, despite numerous legal challenges being rejected, there are still many people who remain convinced that Donald Trump won the election and they're unlikely to change their mind.
Absolutely. And remember, Donald Trump got a massive vote in this election. 74 million people voted for him. He still has this huge support base. And as you said, yes, a huge percentage of that support base believes him when he says that this was stolen, that this was fraud. Surveys have been done. Polling has been done, and there is a high level of belief out there that there was fraud and that there was theft here. I've been covering his Stop the Steal marches and his rallies several days now. These have been going on, and every time you speak to these people, they are utterly convinced. And when you say to them that there is no evidence, that the Attorney General says no fraud, the courts have said no fraud, they will come up with another conspiracy theory and they'll say that everybody is lying and it is the mainstream media putting a spin on this. The only person putting the spin on this is Donald Trump.
Morning Ireland. Later, Philip spoke to Corrie Aihus from Democrats Abroad Ireland and James Connor from Republicans Overseas. And he asked James if it was time for the Republican Party to finally distance themselves from the Donald.
As far as the Republican Party turning their back on them on that, I mean, you know, we could go back to everything that's happened over the past year. Do we know that these people were, in fact, Trump supporters? You know,
you're not going to do that.
Why not?
Are you seriously going to try?
Look up,
Corrie. No, James, let's let Corrie back in there.
From my perspective, you know,
it makes no sense to claim that they were Antifa or that they were,
Why not? Are
you saying they were all actors? Are you saying the people who said that they were there specifically?
I mean, this is the president's own supporters that are supporting their, you know, their own elected official being Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And his agenda that he has been spewing.
Let's just let James respond.
But you can't support Trump without being a traitor. These people are traitors.
How can people make a claim like that? Like you can't.
Well, you're the person who appears to be claiming that the whole thing was a false flag operation. That these weren't Donald Trump supporters.
Are you familiar with Operation Ajax? I suggest looking it up. Now, when Black Lives Matter and Antifa were protesting, everybody said it was peaceful protests, and these were implants that
it's
were raised in hell.
James, do you really want to go there? Do you really
go there? I will go there all day long. I will go there all day long.
Please don't, sir. Clashing voices from a bitterly divided United States. Now, no more nasty news for just a bit. Because yes, it's lockdown, but with lockdown comes another culinary challenge for the Darcy.
How do you keep right? How do you keep your mind and soul and body intact? Well, I think the answer, we have it here. It's a four-letter word. It begins with S, it ends in P, and there's OU in the middle. Soup! Soup will solve all your problems. Yes. We're not going to go back to bacon, sourdough and all that sort of thing. I think soup is what's going to define lockdown number three. It's the perfect look. It's hailstone outside. It's cold. It's wet. It's grey. It's dank. It's mank. It's everything. A nice big pot of soup.
And so it began. Minestrone to kick off. Complicated, it turned out. And the adjudicator was producer Niamh Hassell. And by the time we got to curried butternut squash, it was becoming very clear that our Niamh might have watched one too many MasterChefs.
I have a few questions before I give you my critique, right? Did you caramelise or roast the butternut squash before you put it into the soup, or did you just throw it all in the pot?
I'll tell you how I did it. What I did was I put in shallots and garlic and a bit of ginger, and I just sweated them off.
Yes.
And then, as the recipe that I used suggested, I just put in the cubed butternut squash.
Oh, right, okay.
I didn't roast it.
I thought you might have roasted it.
No, I didn't roast it. And then, but you don't put the, you leave it there for a while, so you don't put the liquid in. So
yeah,
that must caramelise a little bit. You blitz it. And that's it. It's pretty straightforward, very easy.
Right. Well, it was very good.
Was it?
Yes, so I don't know what you were worried about.
Possibly your tone, Niamh. The shallots weren't the only thing sweating there. And she had more of what might be kindly described as notes.
My one critique, right?
Yes,
because it was delicious. It was very spicy. It was very, there was a good kick to it. Very smooth. There was a sweetness. You could taste all the different components to it. And interestingly, you couldn't, you know, some soups where you can just taste stock.
Yes.
You know, and like, but I couldn't taste the stock. So that to me is a good soup, right? But if you were doing it for a fancy dinner party, if you were having, you know, someone over for dinner,
whenever,
right, I would put it through a sieve, and then you would actually refine it down a little
even
bit
more. So it'd
be
even,
like a bisque. Yes, it would
yes,
be smoother.
I see what you're saying. Yes.
A sieve, no less. Swanky. Who'd have thunk it? And who'd have the time? Oh, hold on. It's lockdown. Yeah, we all have the time. Well, that is it for this week's playback. It's been one hell of a start to the year. 2021. Pull your socks up, sir. But it can only get better and brighter, we hope. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.